From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. What makes a story work on the radio?
The big difference for me between a bar story and a story that can be on our show is that a bar story is charming and it's funny and there's something at stake, but it'll lack an original thought. There's no meaning to it. The moment of reflection is what separates conversation from art.
Public Radio's Ira Glass has helped reinvigorate the art of storytelling. Today, we'll talk with Ira about great stories, journalism, and what it's like as a reporter to hang out at a prom as a bunch of high school guys are trying to pull the garters off their dates' bare legs with their teeth. Also, the power of stories from Afghanistan to the magical world of children's books. And we'll visit The Moth, the new hotbed of storytelling in New York City.
Now, I'm not an actor, I have no talent, but that's okay, because no one who works at a Renaissance festival does. What I did have was a girlfriend named Linda Fisher Sinclair. I first met Linda Fisher the summer before when she was a mud wench. She and these other women would wrestle in this pit of thick black muck and hurl insults at each other in iambic pentameter.
There are lots of adult readers who indulge a guilty pleasure. They spend countless hours devouring children's books, and not just Harry Potter. But why? Because they're such good reads. Take Philip Pullman's trilogy, his Dark Materials. Beginning with The Golden Compass, the trilogy tells the story of Lyra, a young girl who sets out to find a friend who's disappeared. Lyra discovers a dangerous world filled with witches, angels, and talking bears, like Yorick Bernison.
Lyra clambered onto the great bear's back, gripping his fur with her mittens and his narrow muscular back between her knees. His fur was wondrously thick, and the sense of immense power she felt was overwhelming. It took some time before she was used to the movement, and then she felt a wild exhilaration. She was riding a bear, and the aurora was swaying above them in golden arcs and loops. And all around was the bitter Arctic cold and the immense silence of the north. They had been traveling for an hour or more, and Lyra was stiff and sore but deeply happy, when Yorick Bernison slowed down and stopped.
"Look up."
She gasped at the sight of the sky. The aurora had faded to a pallid, trembling glimmer, but the stars were as bright as diamonds, and across the great, dark, diamond-scattered vault, hundreds upon hundreds of tiny black shapes were flying out of the east and south towards the north.
"Are they birds?"
"They are witches."
"Witches? What are they doing?"
"Flying to war, maybe. I have never seen so many at one time."
"Do you know any witches, Yorick?"
"I have served some, and fought some, too. If they are flying to the aid of your enemies, you should all be afraid."
He moved on more slowly, and she kept watching the sky until her eyes splintered again with tears of cold, and she saw no end to the numberless witches flying north.
An excerpt from Philip Pullman's novel The Golden Compass. It's pretty gripping stuff, no matter how old you are. In fact, more and more adults are secretly turning to children's books. They say adult fiction just doesn't do much for them. Comes as no surprise to British novelist Amanda Craig. She told Anne Strangechamps that the best children's books are, above all, great stories.
Children's novels, unlike most modern adult novels, have this tremendously strong narrative drive. I mean, anybody who's ever read aloud to a child knows that you can't let their attention waver even for a second. So you've got this thing that is like a sort of G-force almost. It's got to pin that reader to the ground and make them want to read on or go on listening. And that is a tremendous art as well as a craft. In this country, since really for the last 100 years, ever since the Bloomsbury Group and people like E.M. Forster said dreadful things like, "Yes, alas, yes, the novel tells a story." The adult literary novel that tells a story has been very despised. It's been thought that this is something that really is properly only belongs to genre fiction. You know, detective
fiction.
Yeah,
we call that fantasy or science fiction or romance novels.
Precisely.
Or crime fiction.
Yes. So I've been for a long time a bit of a kind of pariah in this country for insisting that no, you know, adult novels too should tell a story. And that is part of what you need as a reader, whether you are a child or whether you're an adult.
Are you saying that you found reading adult novels when you came to them somewhat disappointing after your experience of reading as a child?
Well, I was lucky because my childhood reading, I was very ill as an asthmatic as a child, and my childhood reading sort of segued into adult novels. I mean, I started reading Jane Austen and Dickens at a very, very early age. So I didn't really realise that I'd made this jump. But yes, when I came to read much 20th century fiction, I kept thinking, but why am I bored? Why is this such a great effort? And I remember there's a wonderful English essayist called Francis Spufford who wrote a book that I know is also published in the States called The Child That Books Build. And he describes making exactly the same mistake that I did, buying John Updike's novel, The Centaur, and thinking, but where is the centaur? You know, I bought this book because I want to read about a fabulous mythological creature and it's all about these academics.
You wrote somewhere that to you, a storyteller is a kind of magician. In what way do you think?
Because they take you up and within, you know, three sentences, you're transported into another world, a world that becomes, for the time that you're reading it, more important than your own. You sort of forget about fear, you forget about pain. You know, I know this myself, as I said, because I was so ill as a child when I became addicted to books. And they magically sort of dilate your consciousness. You become aware of all sorts of ways in which other people might think and feel.
What do the great children's books have in common, do you think? I mean, when you look back and remember the books you especially loved as a child when you were ill and reading, is there some common denominator that they share?
I think there are a number of things. One is that the hero or heroine never fits in to their society. I think that taps into a very deep feeling that actually we all have, ironically, that we don't quite fit into the world into which we're born. And therefore, the protagonist who, you know, is a bit odd is like Harry Potter, is a sort of despised, poor, orphan boy who suddenly discovers that in this parallel world he's famous and he's a hero and he's the only person who can, you know, fight Voldemort. It's kind of the fantasy that we all have. But I think another feature is love of animals. I think children are themselves very close to animals. That's one of the things that's so marvellous and funny about them. I know Alison Leary, your wonderful American novelist and essayist on children's fiction, has said that she thinks that all great children's writers are pantheists. And I would very much agree with that. So I think those two strands are very important. But you can have a kind of orphan hero and you can have a great feeling for nature and still not write a really great and gripping children's classic. So, of course, the third part of this has to be the style and the psychology the author brings. Humour, very important.
So which books do you think have most notably achieved that level?
There's someone called Philip Pullman who won the Carnegie Medal for his Dark Materials. And that is, I think, you know, even better than the Harry Potter series. It's not as comforting. It's asking very deep, dark questions about the possible nature of God and death and the soul. I mean, in this parallel universe, people can see their souls as animals, which is a most wonderful idea. And the animals change all through childhood until at a certain point in adolescence, they become fixed. And this is somehow very symbolic, the animal that your soul becomes. I think Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn is a classic. I think the C.S. Lewis Narnia stories are just wonderful. I love the Oz books. I think all these ones that take you out of this world and into the next, Ursula Le Guin's A Wizard of Earthsea, I think is just magnificent.
It strikes me that a number of the books you talked about, the Narnia books, the Oz books, and Harry Potter for that matter, there have been any number of literary reviewers and writers who have really heaped scorn on a bunch of these books. I mean, there are people who have said, you know, in print fairly recently that, well, it's nice that the Harry Potter books are popular, but J.K. Rowling's not a really good writer.
Yes, those people make me very cross. J.K. Rowling is not a great stylist. I don't think anybody would say that her prose was a joy to read. You know, it's not like Philip Pullman's, which is the work of a major writer. But it perfectly achieves what it's trying to do, which is to tell this wonderful story in great detail, very, very clearly. And children who read it love it because they can see the story. I mean, it's no surprise that the film should have been such a hit because it is almost like having a kind of cinema in your head when you read it.
So as a champion of what you could call old-fashioned storytelling and the narrative, are these the kind of novels you've written, novels with very strong plot lines that keep you turning the page and thinking, and what next and what next?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I hope there are a lot of other things that would keep people turning the page. But yes, I mean, I am very aware when I write a novel that every sentence must advance the plot. And, you know, that is as hard a thing to accomplish, if not harder, as actually writing clear and aesthetically pleasing prose. As I said, this attitude has been very much despised until quite recently. However, it has had very much more eminent supporters. The Canadian novelist Robertson Davis, for instance, was very strong on the importance of storytelling. And I think even people like your own Saul Bellow, when he made his Nobel Prize speech, when he was talking about how the novel promises us meaning, harmony, and even justice. I mean, how else are you to convey that but through storytelling? He's a wonderful storyteller, I think.
You're now also working on a children's book or a children's trilogy of your own. How is that different? I mean, is the writing experience different in any way?
Well, yes, it's different to an extent because, I mean, children are people, you know, they're just like us. They're not, you know, these completely alien beings, but we just know so much more than they do. So, for instance, the whole level of, well, obviously sexual awareness that you acquire as an adolescent isn't there with children. But because they lack experience, they can do things that are very much more extraordinary and courageous because they're much more fearless. And my three children, I mean, this has magic in it, but they set off on this extraordinary quest, which no adult would undertake in a million years because they're travelling further and further north. They've got practically nothing with them but three horses and some food. You know, no adult would do that. But these three children are going to do it, and they're going to succeed in rescuing somebody.
Amanda Craig, talking with Anne Strangechamps from the BBC Studios in London. Craig's novels include In a Dark Wood and Love in Idleness. Storytelling festivals are popping up around the country. You'll hear folk tales, tall tales, ghost stories, and a whole lot else. Typically, they're fun and folksy, but you'd have to say not exactly hip. But now there's another kind of storytelling, what you might call stories as an urban art form. In New York City, a group called The Moth holds story slams at clubs around town. Reporter Matt Lieber went to one to find out what makes a good story and why storytelling can pose some rather complicated ethical questions.
When I arrive for the story slam, there's a long line of people standing on the sidewalk waiting to get in.
The dumber they are, the better they are.
One of the people not standing in line is Jeffrey Rudell. He is rather kneeling in line and scribbling intently in a notebook.
I see that you're jotting down notes. Is this the story you're hoping to tell?
I have two stories. Neither of them are prepared, so I thought I'd kind of run over them in my head, because on stage you're not allowed any notes. I have one story about growing up on a farm in Michigan and working in a chicken farm under these big metal pole barns. It's really gross, so it's been modified a little, not to exaggerate it, more to diminish it, because it's really gross, and I needed to take some of that stuff out for the audience, I thought.
Jeffrey is actually a Moth veteran, and he's this year's Story Slam champion, which means basically that he's won a number of these Story Slam competitions already. To win a story slam, you have to do something deceptively simple. You have to tell a good story. The format of the evening goes something like this. If you want to tell a story, you put your name in a hat. If your name is drawn, you get up on stage and you tell your story. The atmosphere is friendly and relaxed, but there are a few rules. To begin with, your story must address a pre-announced theme. The story should have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it should be no more than 5 minutes long. The stories are judged by the audience, and if you break the rules, your score suffers.
Often, though, I mean, there are times when I've sort of embellished a story if I thought it would make it a little better, but try not to make that evident when I'm telling it. You kind of have to get up there and be real. If you try to act, you try to do stand-up, the audience doesn't really like it, your score goes way down. So it has to be a good story, it has to be clear, and you've got 5 minutes to do it.
Jeffrey's idea about a story being real is something that a lot of people at the Moth say is very important. The tricky thing is, it takes some effort to achieve this kind of natural voice. You might rehearse the story, or in Jeffrey's case, tinker with the details. In other words, there's a lot of contrivance involved in making a story sound real. Inside, there's a bar, and once people are let in, there's a good half hour of drinking and conversation before the stories start. There's a stage at the back of the bar, with a microphone and proper lighting, and in front of the stage, there are a number of small, round cocktail tables. It looks like a comedy club, except what goes on here is very much not stand-up comedy. For one thing, the audience is a lot friendlier. It's not an accident that this feels like a cocktail party. In fact, The Moth was started as a kind of social experiment by a novelist from Georgia named George Green. He felt that the stories he heard at New York parties were not fully formed narratives. What he heard were just anecdotes or witticisms, which he found unsatisfying. He was drawn more to the fully wrought stories you hear in the Southern oral tradition. So, in a very clever act of social engineering, he invited friends to his apartment and told them to bring a story to tell, and The Moth was born. The model here is sort of a cocktail party, or a dinner party, just one where the rules of engagement are clear from the start. I talked to a woman in the audience who seemed pretty shy, and she agreed that going to The Moth was not like going to a regular New York City bar.
Well, I've been twice before, and both times I came by myself. And both times I ended up talking to the people that I was sitting with, standing next to, whatever, which is sort of strange, I think, in New York City. And it wasn't like a pickup scene or anything like that. We were just talking. There's something, I don't know, it's very just relaxed and unintimidating here.
Here's the thing about parties. The best parties are the ones with the best stories, and the best guests are the ones who tell the best stories. The genius of The Moth is that it reduces the cocktail party to its barest essence, the story. We often rehearse for a party, and when we get there, we perform. The great thing about The Moth is that it gets rid of the pretense that we're there to do anything else.
Let's welcome to everybody our last winner, Dave Mowers.
The only problem is that no matter how much you've prepared for your performance, it's still difficult to tell a good story.
Hi, I'm Dave Mowers. Thanks for coming.
But the storytellers are aware of this problem, so they've devised ways to make their stories foolproof.
Imagine a round yellow sun high in the sky. Imagine waves of bleached white grass.
Dave Mowers, who's earned the only guaranteed spot on stage tonight by winning the last Story Slam, has gone so far as to compose his entire story on paper, memorize it word for word, and try it out on a friend to make sure it will be a hit. His story is about working at a Renaissance fair, one of those simulated worlds where every employee pretends to be a character and dresses up in costume and speaks with a fake accent.
Now, I'm not an actor. I have no talent. But that's okay, because no one who works at a Renaissance festival does. What I did have was a girlfriend named Linda Fisher Sinclair. She was my motivation for living backwards in time. I first met Linda Fisher the summer before when she was a mud wench. It's one of the best jobs that you can get there. It's very high paying. She and these other women would wrestle in this pit of thick black muck and hurl insults at each other in iambic pentameter. I took one look at Linda Fisher Sinclair and I fell in love. I seduced her with the Palmer's Psalm from Romeo and Juliet.
Dave's is easily the most meticulously composed story of the night. He comes in and out of the voices of different characters, and there are jokes deployed at the right times, and the story is a riotous success.
She kissed me, and I was straight.
One of the judges told me why she liked Dave's story so much.
It was an actual story. It seemed like it had a beginning, a middle, an end. He tied everything together. It was very interesting. It was compelling. It was funny. He had a great delivery. The way he told it, it made it seem like, you know, he actually did these things, you know, with the medieval times or whatever.
But when I talked to Dave at intermission, he told me that his story wasn't actually true.
It's a lie. I told you before it was true, and it's because I think that you should always let people believe the story is true, but I made mine up.
So nothing about your story is true?
Nothing.
It's often said that fiction has the power to reveal greater truths than fact. But when an audience believes it is hearing a story that actually happened, a story that has the personal and self-effacing ring of realness, aren't we being fleeced when the story is entirely invented, when it's an exercise in self-promotion?
I feel like there's something implicit in storytelling that says, take me somewhere, give me something, show me something. And sometimes the stories that I tell are true from my own life, but I'm not necessarily the most interesting person in the world. And so why not give them something, take them somewhere, show them something?
It's startling to hear Dave admit that his story is made up, mostly because it reveals the tension of the Moth's two competing forces, realness and fraud. The Moth does elevate casual storytelling to the level of theater, and it does foster a natural voice in an unnatural setting. But it does all that by turning people into liars, which might actually say less about the Moth than it does about the business of storytelling itself.
Well, the next summer, Linda Fisher Sinclair moved to Nashville, Tennessee to become a country western singer. And I returned to the Renaissance Festival to make love to a queen.
Matt Lieber is an independent producer in New York City. What do you think about storytelling? Is there anything wrong with tales that stretch the truth? We'd like to hear from you. Send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll chat with Ira Glass about telling stories on the radio and why there should be a place for storytelling on the nightly news.
The news has an aesthetics, and part of the aesthetics of the news traditionally is that serious and funny are not allowed to touch. It's like if they touch, the world explodes and you can't trust the newscaster or something. And I feel like that is really primitive thinking.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Ira Glass has created a distinctive style of storytelling. His radio show, This American Life, blends journalism with personal essays and fiction, and a healthy dose of music. Before he had his own show, Ira worked for years at NPR, first as an intern and later as a producer and reporter. He recently stopped by our studios and sat down with Steve Paulson. Steve asked Ira if he'd always wanted to tell stories on the radio.
No. No, it took me a really long time to actually get competent in telling stories on the radio. I was maybe the slowest learner ever. Like, I was a tape cutter at NPR starting from the time I was 19 or 20. And really, I couldn't actually write a decent radio story in a timely way until I was 28 or 29.
So what happened when you were around 28 or 29? Sort of what got you to the point where what you were really interested in was telling stories?
I noticed as a tape cutter that there would be certain stories that would just get to me. And I would notice in the tape I was cutting that sometimes there would be a little passage where I just think, like, this is completely working. You know? And then I would really think about, why does this section work and not this? Why does this part of the interview work and not this? And I came to a set of thoughts about how you'd make a story compelling on the radio that then I tried to enact in producing and reporting. I really think that actually telling a story is the thing that radio can do most compellingly.
So before you started This American Life, were you always trying to sneak stories into the journalism that you
Yes.
were doing for NPR?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that was actually a real key was figuring out how to express amazement, like figuring out that like stories are all better if they're surprising and how to get surprise in. I mean, if you think about the aesthetics of the news, okay, the news has an aesthetics. And we don't often think of it that way because we don't think of it as an art form. But like any communicative act, the news has an aesthetics. And part of the aesthetics of the news traditionally is that the reporter is supposed to be this sort of unassailable authority figure. And I feel like the cornier newscasters in broadcast journalism, the way that they handle that is that they give everything with a sort of deep voice and like, you know, like the newscaster on the Simpsons, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like everything's got to be, you know, very serious. And if you look at especially local TV news in most places, there's a kind of staged theatrical sort of seriousness to the whole thing. And then it'll be like sort of serious story, serious story, serious story. And then at the end of the broadcast, there'll be the wacky guy. And he'll either mm-hmm. be the sports guy or the weather guy or what the designated wacky person. On 60 Minutes, they even have when they have that guy.
Andy Rooney.
Andy Rooney, right. So there's this aesthetic of like, you know, the serious and the funny can't meet. And I feel like that just seems really moronic to me. Because, you know, in the most serious moments, things that are funny will happen. And the funniest moments are most effective. Like if there's something that's really funny, it actually has a kind of serious undercurrent. I remember in one of the first documentary series I did for NPR on an assignment for them, they sent me into this high school for 6 weeks or 8 weeks and to do this 5-part series. And one of the moments that I reported on for them was I went to the prom. And I, in fact, over the course of doing stories about schools, I stayed for a year in another school and spent months in another school, went back to the first school years later. So the kids who I had known as freshmen were now seniors, and we did a series about who had dropped out and who hadn't and why. And I've been to the prom 5 times as a reporter, as an adult. And I have to say, like, I don't recommend it. It's not – you don't want to go to the prom 5 times as an adult. So this is one of the times, and there was this moment that my editor and I, we put in the story simply because – like it blew our minds. You can hear in the clip, you can hear that what's going on is I am amazed. You can hear that I am amazed and I thought it was funny and that's why it's in the story. And because at home you'll hear it and it's kind of, I was maybe a little out of touch with today's youth.
What happened? What was amazing?
Well, I can even play it for you.
Oh, that'd be great.
On the dance floor, there was a certain amount of copping feels and kissing. But the sexual tension at the prom hit a kind of surreal zenith when the DJ told the boys to bring chairs down to the dance floor. Girls were seated in the chairs, and the garter ceremony began.
We're going to count down from 10.
Over 100 teenage girls presented bare legs with garters.
All men have to put your hands behind your back.
Meaning, grab the garter with your teeth.
All right, we want to count backwards from 10. 10. 9.
This is the kind of activity that separates the just friends prom dates from the real dates. And dozens of just friends stood around the edges of the hall in various states of discomfort.
3, 2, 1.
100 kneeling teenage boys bring their faces up against the slightly sweaty thighs of their dates, grip multicolored garters with their teeth, and drag them off the leg. It's a shocking and amazing sight. But when I ask teachers about it later, they all say, "Where have you been? They've done this for years." At homecoming, apparently, things get even more explicit.
Woo! All right. Okay, let's move the chairs and we'll have a slow dance.
It sounds so not only embarrassing that moment. Were you embarrassed when you were there recording
horrified.
All of this?
I was horrified. Like, there's some things that, like, when you're hanging around with teenagers and you're recording them for day upon day, like, you do feel embarrassed quite a bit. And, like, this was definitely a scene. And I was truly surprised. I was just like, this is high school now? Like where have I been?
Now, one of the things that you do a lot on your show is first-person narratives. I mean, basically, we hear someone telling a story. And it seems that there's a real hunger for this kind of thing in our culture right now that maybe wasn't there a generation ago. What do you think is going on?
I think part of it is that we're just inundated with stories all the time. You know, we've all seen so much TV and we've seen so many movies and we've heard so many stories that for it to have a little extra oomph, it helps if it's true.
I would think one of the occupational hazards that you would run into on your show is trying to figure out if anyone would care about this particular story.
Oh,
I mean, what makes
problem.
It just, you know,
oh,
this one person's good story, but just sort of a personal story? What gives it some kind of universal appeal?
That is like the bane of my life is that problem. You know, you interview people on the radio and don't people sometimes say to you, well, you know, everybody's got a story.
Right.
You know,
oh, yeah.
And I feel like, yeah, everybody's got a story.
But is it worth listening to?
Exactly. Exactly. And what's really horrible is that sometimes someone will send us a truly tragic story, like something horrible that happened, you know, their children got very ill or a spouse died or just, you know, just the most horrible things that can, you know, happen to a person. But they don't say anything surprising in it. And they don't express it in a poetic way. And really, it's kind of lays out exactly like you'd expect it would. And then you're like, well, what do I, like, am I supposed to, like, call them back and say, I'm sorry, you know.
You just really had a lousy life.
But you can't, like, yeah, it's just not interesting. You don't want to ever have to say that.
So you're really talking about two parts to this. I mean, there's the telling of the story, the narrative, kind of what happens, then what next, but there's also, what does it mean?
Yeah, the what does it mean is a big problem. We do a lot of stories. We do a lot of, we generate a lot of material where they're really great stories, but no one says anything about them. Sometimes the thought that the person has isn't that interesting, but the facts of the story are really beautiful and they're expressed beautifully. I'll play you a clip from a thing that I did when I was still a producer for NPR before I was really on the air. I had a whole series of stories that I did where I don't appear in the story because I was such a horrible writer and not a very good performer. And so this is from that. I would basically sit down with people and interview them for an hour, and then I would chop out my questions and interview them in a way where they would do exactly this. They would lay out the anecdote, and then they would have moments of reflection. And this particular one is a guy named Bradley Harrison Picklesheimer. And we're coming in kind of halfway in the story. What he did is that he's this guy who grew up in a small town in Kentucky and had always read about like high society parties, how the rich and famous live. So he moves to West Palm Beach, Florida, and he gets a job in the party business, like, you know, catering and preparing parties for these super high-end parties. And in the first part of this story, he just tells the narrative of he was working a party where they spent $400,000 just for one night. And he sort of lays out everything they did. And then he comes to the first moment of reflection of the piece. And as you'll hear, the moment of reflection isn't the biggest thought. And then he launches into the next anecdote. And sometimes I play this particular clip of tape for reporters because there's a rule of thumb about the whole thing, about having somebody tell a story on the radio, where if you're interviewing somebody, one of the ways to almost guarantee that the story will go better is to make them give you the dialogue. That is, then he said this, and then I said this, and then he said this, and I said this. And you'll hear in this stretch of the – in this thing, Bradley totally – he just breaks into the dialogue. And the reason why it's really perfect for radio is because at that point, the story is moving in real time. It's happening on the radio at exactly the speed it would happen in real life. So here's Bradley.
And they treat the help like the help, you know, and the country – you know, the country – boy in me wanted to say, now listen here, honey, you ain't no better than anybody else, you know. But on the other hand, you want her business next year, and you say, yes, Mrs. So-and-so, because when you deal with very wealthy people, they want what they want, and someone will give it to them.
Before we go to the next section, you see, that's the moment of reflection, right? And it's kind of a stupid one, but it's enough to hold up the anecdote that's about to follow.
There was this one time where we did this party for an estate in Long Island, and they had planted these flower beds, and all the flowers came up, and they were all blue. But in this one bed, there's this one little yellow flower sticking out. And we were out there working, putting the party up, and all of a sudden, like, everything sort of stopped, and all the gardeners stopped, and all the workmen stopped, and this little old woman wiggled out on a cane, silver cane, in a nightgown, and pointed at that little yellow flower. That one right there. Take that out of there. And honey, these gardeners just snapped, and just like this flower had never existed. And then later on, my friend Tom from New York, he was out by the truck crying. I said, what is wrong with you? He said, you know, I just realized I'm never going to be that rich. I'm never going to ever be able to do that. And I just thought, well, honey, who'd want to? I thought that little flower just added everything to this estate. Myself, I felt like that little flower was me, you know, and it snuck its way into the bulb beds and waited down there all winter long to aggravate her and got her dead ass out of that mansion to come out there and bitch at the servants to get rid of that little yellow flower. So I loved it. I loved the whole idea of it. And that was the only time we ever saw her.
That's wonderful. So how did you get that story? I mean, how did you get him to tell that?
He and I talked for a long time, and he told me a number of stories. He was a friend of a friend, and he was coming through town, and she's like, man, you should talk to this guy. And, you know, sometimes you do that and nothing happens, and sometimes you do it and there's somebody like Bradley who, you know, honestly, like, you can have him tell any story. Like, what'd you have for breakfast today, Bradley? And he, like, launches his own story.
Do you coach him, though, about how to tell it? You know, it's like you want him to try to recreate the dialogue, for instance?
I absolutely coached him very aggressively. Like, but the kind of coaching it is, I mean, is closer to normal interviewing, where I just say, wait, I act all stupid. I mean, wait, just go back. Just wait, explain. Like, so, what happened? Like, he comes out and he says, what to you? Just explain it again. I'm not sure we've got it. And then, so there's, like, a lot of, like, egging people on.
I love that moment, too, where you say, everything stopped, and then the music stops.
Well, that's such a radio trick. Like, you know, if you've got the music running underneath and the music suddenly goes away, you know, we could do that right now. You know, if you've got a piece of music and the music's running underneath us and we're talking and talking, and you got one of those This American Life pieces of music, so it's got a certain mood and it's like you feel sort of forward motion. And then as I'm talking, if the music just sort of slowly goes away as I'm talking, whatever I say next sounds really, really important. Like the silence, the sudden silence brackets the thought.
Do you worry at all about being too manipulative, that you're sort of like yanking the listener's feelings around?
No. It's like, you know, you want to be manipulated in a certain way. You know, you want it to really just get to you. And you just hope that the people doing the manipulating have good judgment and aren't lying.
Well, let me ask you about that lying. Because you do so many personal stories,
right?
You're just kind of assuming, I guess, that what people are telling you is true. I mean, you're billing this as nonfiction.
Right.
Does that worry you? Do you try to check up on anything at all?
We do try to check up on certain stories where there's something at stake and the people in the stories, you know, might be portrayed in a way which is unfair to them. We absolutely check on those. In a story like Bradley's, like, I have no way to check that story. If he's exaggerating because he likes to tell a whopper, you know what? Like, at some level, I feel like it probably makes me a bad journalist, but I just don't care.
Mm-hmm. And you still consider yourself a journalist?
I feel like even the question makes me sad that you have to ask that. Really? It doesn't seem like journalism?
I don't – I mean, maybe it's not a meaningful question. I don't know.
Well, I mean, they're true stories, and I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm a former producer of All Things Considered. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I was a reporter. I have a business card from National Public Radio. I don't know. Like, it's journalism. Yeah, we make it accurate. We go out. We tape the people. We write down what we say. We put it on the radio. That's what a journalist does. You know, we're fair at all parties. And, I mean, it's applying the tools of journalism, which are normally applied to the famous and the powerful, to everyday life.
Ira Glass, host of the public radio show This American Life, talking with Steve Paulson. One of Ira's favorite stories is a piece he produced years ago for NPR's Morning Edition, a diary entry by David Sedaris.
May 26, 1991. Hugh and I met up after his appointment and spent a few hours at the Central Park Zoo. I was disappointed the first time I went because, as far as animals go, it isn't much. The main attraction at the Central Park Zoo are the divorced fathers enduring their weekend of custody. I like to watch these men stand beside their children at the polar bear display and say, "Did you see that? The mother bear is saying to her husband, 'Get away, you. I've got problems of my own.' See how she's swatting at him? All he does is try to make her happy, and she doesn't appreciate it because she's too caught up in her own little world to understand that he has problems too." We overheard divorced parents explaining themselves through polar bears, seals, tortoises, monkeys, and tropical birds. "Look at how she's pecking at him with her colorful beak. That must hurt." On our way out, Hugh stopped to make a phone call. The telephones are located near the restrooms, and I stood waiting for him to finish his call when I heard a voice coming from the women's bathroom. A high-pitched voice screaming, "I love you, I love you, I love you, but I don't know how to love you." The voice was hysterical and relentless and repeated the sentence over and over again. "I love you, I love you, I love you, but I don't know how to love you." Hugh finished the call and was ready to leave, but I couldn't go until I identified that voice. So we waited beside the telephone until a crying girl, maybe 7 years old, stomped out of the bathroom with a woman I assumed to be her mother. They were dressed alike in fine plaid jumpers, both of them with red velvet bows in their hair. The child stamped her feet and repeated her line one last time before her mother grabbed her hand and led her away. "I love you, I love you, I love you, but I don't know how to love you." After a certain age, that becomes the story of your life, and you'll repeat that phrase in one form or another every time you open your mouth. But why start now, at her age? I thought about this all afternoon.
That's David Sedaris. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. When Syra Shah was growing up, her father used to tell stories about fantastic places in Afghanistan, like the magical garden where fountains sprayed diamond droplets into a pool. The water itself had magical properties. After you ate to the point of bursting, you could step to the brook and drink, and you'd be ready for another meal. Syra's father was Afghan. He wanted his daughter to know his country, even though they lived in England. Syra grew up with a hunger to visit Afghanistan. Eventually she did, as a journalist covering the Mujahideen's war against the Soviets. Shah went on to make an acclaimed documentary about the Taliban called Under the Veil. And now she's written a memoir, The Storyteller's Daughter.
My father told me all sorts of stories. There were snippets of legend, myth, bits of Afghan history, just out-and-out fairy stories, folk stories.
You actually grew up in Britain, but your father wanted you to feel as though Afghanistan was your home?
Yes, we were from a very mixed family, and I was born in Britain. English is my mother tongue, but certainly at the time when I was growing up, you never really were quite allowed to feel that you belonged there. And I think my father used stories to try to create a sense of identity, to create a sense of culture. It was something he wanted us to have.
These stories that your father told you, some of them sound so fanciful that it's unlikely, I guess, that a rational Western person, even a rational Western child, would treat them as reality. Did they sound as though they had some other kind of truth to you when you were a kid?
I'm sure they did as well, but I think that, you know, what is it they say? They say, give me a child before he's 7 years old. And I think that they kind of get in under the barriers, you know, when you're a little kid, especially if you want to believe. And it was very important to me. It sort of probably fell into the same category as believing that you're really a fairy princess and don't belong to your parents at all. You know, all that sort of thing. Really, I didn't just come from this boring old place in Kent. I came from somewhere much more exciting and better, and it made me feel special. So I was very receptive to it. And you're absolutely right. There was also another aspect in that my family comes from a very storytelling culture, but the effect that it had on me was perhaps the struggle between, I mean, in the book I've called it my Eastern mind and my Western mind, but, you know, you could easily call it the sort of the more literal part of the brain and your more sort of romantic, creative part of the brain. And those two really were at war in me. I loved the fairy stories, but I wanted to know how much of them was literally true. And so I had this sort of real conflict, and it got to the point where I needed to go to Afghanistan to try and sort out myth from reality as I saw it then.
He also told you some stories that I gather had some truth in them. You relate one about your Afghan ancestor.
John Fashan Khan, yes. I was actually amazed to discover that story. I actually went to the British Library and looked it up. It's an absolute wild story about how my ancestor thought that he was going to be given Delhi if he helped storm the Red Fort during the mutiny. And, of course, the British reneged, but in that fighting, he lost six of his sons. One after another, he sent them up the side of the fort, our family story goes, and one after another, they got shot down, and finally the old Afghan warlord climbed the side of the fort himself, and he was successful. And then afterwards, he went off and had a whole load more sons. And when my brother and sister and I heard this story, we were always very, very ambivalent about it, because on one side, my father absolutely had no doubt about it. It was like, Jean Fajan Khan, he was great, that was fantastic. And we were kind of going, yes, but what about his six sons? Maybe he should have gone up himself first in the first place. But to my amazement, when I actually went to the British Library and started checking, I didn't find the whole story, but I did find references to the kind of terrible sacrifices that Jean Fashan Khan had made during that fighting. So there obviously was something that happened. And sometimes when I was traveling in Afghanistan, I'd get a glimpse of something. I'd understand things because I'd had the myths and the stories, even if they weren't literally true.
You feel a very strong connection to Afghanistan, whether you have actually lived there or not. How much time have you spent there?
Well, I spent in the 80s, I went and stayed for 3 years, and I was based in Peshawar, just on the other side of the border in Pakistan, but I used to go a lot with the Afghan Mujahideen. And then between then and when the Taliban came in, then I used to go to Afghanistan as a journalist regularly, fairly regularly. And then the latest thing was in the Taliban time and just after the Taliban, making Beneath the Veil and Unholy War. So a fair amount. But the one thing I really regret is that I have never lived in Afghanistan. It's something I'd actually like to do very soon.
I want to ask you about what your father's stories have done to your ability to tell and to recognize stories. I was thinking about, I think it's in the post-Taliban time. Maybe it was during the Taliban time. You were in a Pakistani refugee camp, and there was a young boy who had had a horrible experience, I think.
Yes.
But he told the story four or five different ways.
Yes, that was a strange thing. It was one of those moments where you suddenly see something in a flash and think that perhaps, you know, you've learned something from this person. And I also felt desperately sorry for him because he was a little boy. He'd obviously been very traumatized by something. And you know how it is when you're there and you're a journalist and you're trying to get to the truth, and that by the truth you mean the facts. And, you know, there's a child and he's getting confused and you're trying not to upset him. But the director was pushing me to keep asking him, because every time he told the story of what had happened, which was something to do with having seen his neighbour shot, she'd been hiding in the vines and the Taliban had come and shot her. But he'd get the facts a bit different every time. And so, you know, the director kept saying to me, no, ask him again, ask him again. And I really didn't want to ask him again because I could see it was upsetting him. But I was sort of being weak myself and like carrying on and asking. And finally, this little boy had obviously just reached the point where he'd had enough. And he said to me, she was hiding in the vines and the Taliban came and shot her. And then her mother came to weep over her body. But then the girl opened her eyes and she was alive again. And that very day she was married and there was a great celebration. And I suddenly realised that perhaps something about what myths and stories are for in their sort of healing capacity, in that that boy had invented that story. I don't know what he'd seen. I don't know if he'd seen the girl being shot in the vines. I don't know if he'd seen something else, but he'd obviously seen something. But that story had enabled him to sort of suddenly heal the experience and make it bearable for himself.
Does it change how you perceive yourself as a journalist then, to have an understanding of that power of storytelling?
Do you know, I don't think it does greatly as a journalist, because I think as a journalist your duty is to the facts rather than, I mean, for want of a better word, to the truth. And I don't think that the facts and the truth are always the same. Sometimes you can reach truth in different ways. Stories, I think, do reach truth in different ways, but, you know, not necessarily a factual way. But I think if you are a journalist, then you've nailed your colours to the mask and you have to stick to the facts. And that's something that really, you know, I've had death threats from insisting on that.
Tell me about your film. Beneath the Veil was about the human rights abuses of the Taliban. What did you have to do in order to make that film?
We made three trips, one to Pakistan, one to northern Afghanistan, to the opposition-held area, and one to the Taliban's Afghanistan, Taliban's Kabul and Kandahar with visas. And that all took, I think about 9 weeks or something like that. And then at the end of that, we sat down and tried to work out what we'd got and what we hadn't got. And although we had some very strong, very, very strong material, the one thing that we hadn't got was we hadn't been able to talk to ordinary people, particularly women, who were living in the Taliban's regime. And the reason for that was very simple, that, you know, you had minders with you. You actually had it written in your visa that you were not allowed to talk to women and you're not allowed to visit Afghans in their homes. And, you know, we could have given our minders the slip, but, you know, if we'd been caught, we'd have been fine, but the people we spoke to would have been in trouble. So we thought that I should go back and do an undercover. So that's what I did. I put on a burqa and went with a very, very brave group of women called the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, and went into Kabul and saw secret schools, hospitals, all sorts of things. Yeah.
Some of the stories that you tell in The Storyteller's Daughter are about that, going with, I assume, a camera under your burqa. I mean, one of the advantages of
some
this
of
horrible
time,
garment
yes.
is that
yes,
you can hide
absolutely.
Things.
Yes, yeah, I had a couple of cameras. I had one that was just had a pinhole that went in the burqa, and then I had one that was actually in a bag. We called it the Kill Me Quick camera, just jokingly among the team and me, because it had a great big hole. It was made by, I shouldn't really say this, but it was made by the BBC special department. They've got a special department for making kit, and it had this huge hole in it, and it just seemed so, you know, you could actually see the lens if you look straight at it. But it was kind of funny, that bag. Yeah.
You went, one of the stories you tell is of going into a hospital ward.
Yes, yes. That was probably the scariest thing, because it was all women. So we had to take the burqas off when we went in. And so I knew I had to use the bag camera. And I was with this guide from RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. And she was obviously very, very scared. And I was scared too, but I could see that she, you know, she was really giving off very scared signals. And so I remember I took her away into the corridor and I kind of tried to explain to her, because you get used as a journalist just to blagging a bit. You have to sort of close down all your vibes. Don't give off any vibes like you don't want to be there. And you can actually almost become invisible just by giving off the right vibes. And so we did. She caught on, and we went round the wards being very, very confident, saying, "We're looking for our friend, you know, she's ill, she's on another ward." And we had, you know, all the nurses were running around trying to get us, the patients and their relatives were running around trying to find out, you know, where this woman was. And it was, you know, it was all right in the end, but it was pretty scary.
Saira Shah has gone on to cover many hotspots in the Middle East. Recently, she was filming a documentary in the Gaza Strip when her director, James Miller, who was standing right next to her, was shot and killed by an Israeli soldier. Saira Shah's memoir is called The Storyteller's Daughter. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Storytelling, program number 928B. If you'd like to comment on the show, just send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Ann Strangechamps, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.